The first question I wanted to ask you, mm-hmm. which... What the hell is that? It's a question I have already asked you, but...
I remember that.
You remember that?
Yes.
It's a question about looking at your books and looking in little presses where you're printed. You give no biographical detail at all. And I wanted to know if this was a conscious policy that you felt that poets shouldn't divulge anything about themselves as a person.
Well, no, it's not a conscious policy, but I don't like doing things which don't have any great point to them. So if I were to, apart from writing poems, start writing a sort of running autobiography every time I have a book published, I'd want to know, who wanted this information and why. But you have got to be, careful as a poet in a way. There have been instances in the past of poets who've got sort of swamped in their own biographies and their reputations as characters, figures, and things like that. I suppose a lot of people are perhaps a bit wary of that. But the basic notion is simply that what I do is on the page, and that's all I do, basically. Anything else I do is a kind of optional extra, including things like poetry readings, actually, are totally unnecessary. They earn a nice penny now and then, sometimes, but they are strictly in the margin, anything like that, really. And in the last analysis, it doesn't matter whether I was born in Stockport in 1940 or Timbuktu in 1889, really, because you've still got the same thing on the page. But, I mean, wherever I was born or whatever I am, whatever colour of ears I've got or anything, No, it isn't a deliberate policy, there's just a disregard for that kind of information,
yeah.
Really.
So that you're not worried about people misinterpreting what you write. I mean, if there's only you send this page out into the world and they pick it up, you don't worry if they get the signals crossed.
Well, I couldn't do anything to stop them anyway, I don't think. Really, if they're going to get the signals crossed, they're probably going to, no matter what I say about it, really. Because whatever I say, they're always aware that it's something I'm saying, it's not the poem. Mm. The poem's still a completely open construct on the page. I can't force anybody to read it in any particular way at all.
Do you want people to hear you reading your poems aloud?
What do you mean by important? I mean, it might help, though what helps isn't necessarily of the first importance, Because what's always important to me is what helps me to write the poetry. And that doesn't help me at all, really. I mean, I find it's enough of a struggle writing it without worrying about other things, really. I mean, it does help me sometimes to hear it occasionally, but not very much.
What about the other people? I mean, or do they not matter?
Well, they matter, but that's... my job is to write it, you see. It's difficult.
Could Mr.
Yeager
just sit in for half an hour?
Does that answer your question? Is that the kind of thing you're thinking of?
Yes.
Yeah.
Does that mean that when you're composing, you don't compose out loud?
Oh, never. I use a typewriter. A typewriter isn't like a musical instrument that you work with, I find. I mean, I don't know anybody who sort of spouts it aloud while... I mean, they say that people like Swinburne used to do that.
And Wordsworth.
Yeah, that's just a way of... I guess that they'd have done that after they've finished a passage, not while they're actually working at it. I wouldn't have thought. It's a thing that never occurred to me to do. I wouldn't dream of doing it, actually. It might disturb the neighbours or something, No, the typewriter is an instrument. I can hardly write without one, actually. I've got difficulty writing with a... I don't mean physically, but I mean, difficult to write poetry or anything with an ordinary pen, because I've been using a typewriter for so long anyway, so it is a kind of typewriter poetry.
Does the typewriter impose its own rules of composition?
No, not in any serious sense, no. Only in terms of how long a piece of paper is and things like that, I'm very interested in the concept of the page as a unit, which, like a lot of other things, are formal units of poetry, sonnets, pages... books and things like that. They're all in the same category to me. Some of them more difficult than others. Obviously, a sonnet is a more difficult category than a page. but they're still all formal categories of poetry. And I quite, I get a bit worried if a poem goes over a page, actually, because it means the page ought to be complete in some sense. If it goes over the page, then there's got to be something complete about the existing page. This is true of most of my books, actually.
There's is it in preparations? You've got one page where there's very long, dense bit of writing, and then a very light page with a lot of white spaces on it. Was the dense bit quite purposely then kind of packed into a page?
Only in the sense I didn't want it to go beyond a page. Mm. But there's not much danger of that these days. And the modern typewriter page is pretty big anyway. You don't have to worry about it too much. But that's the case with the thing you've given out, actually. Mm. And that's to do with the sequence. Mm. There's a variety of things happening along the sequence. One is that poems contract and expand, you get a little poem and then a great splodge of writing. It doesn't always, it just happens sometimes.
Mm.
Yeah.
Barry McSweeney has labelled you an academic poet. Do you think that's a useful or a correct label?
No, I don't know what he's talking about, silly oaf. No, he just means he finds me difficult to read. That's all he means by that.
Mm. But he's difficult to read as well.
I don't think he's very difficult to read, no. I think I'm a bit more difficult to read than he is nowadays, actually. What he means apart from what he could possibly mean apart from that, I don't know. I mean, to me, the academy is a very precise term. It just means the university, really. To be academic is to be involved in university matters.
Yes.
And matters of scholarship and learning, which I am, but no more than many other people are involved with learning and knowledge and things like that. It's true that, I do use areas of knowledge more than other people. That's not necessarily academic.
What sort of knowledge?
Anything I can pick up, actually. You write poetry by having you have obsessions, and you work your way through them. And like this book that you've got bits of was part of a long-standing obsession with music, certain musicians and their music, which worked its way out in many ways, partly in musical journalism, partly in record reviewing, partly in writing poetry. It seems at last, fortunately, to be finished. It lasts a long time, this obsession. Where did I begin saying this?
What am I talking about?
Oh, yes. And the obsession you work through could be an obsession that involves research. Well, it always involves research in some sense or other. It's research into moments of your own existence or research into something fairly academic, you know. But it's dangerous to categorise anybody anyway, you know, especially in such a volatile medium as poetry, where you think you've got somebody fixed and they can turn around and write something completely different the next day. You know, I mean, you've got a rhyming poem by me there, which must be almost the only one I've ever written, you know, and that, if I'm not careful, I shall be thought of around the Warwick regions as a rhyming
lyric
or a lyric poem, something, you know, that sort of thing can happen easily. Yeah.
Can I ask about influence? There's a piece you did in one of the Poetry Information which seemed to be rather strongly rejecting influence from America and France, which on the other hand you've done things which I think it was a review of Wyndham Lewis.
Oh yes.
But on the other hand you've done that piece called Mist, which is kind of playing around with French writer. Are you aware of any particular influences or of influences you're trying to reject?
I'm not happy about the word influence, actually. I once received a letter from a gent in Cambridge who wanted a short reply on the Marxist influence on my poetry, and I wrote him a 10-page letter analysing what could possibly be meant by influence. You know, it means an influx of something into something, like filling a tank with water. And the word's used very casually and easily, and nobody knows what this is, what substance is going into what receptacle when you're talking about influence. I mean, you read all sorts of things. Yeah, and when you start off, you imitate furiously. I still do. All right through your career, you imitate. It's helpful if you know you're imitating. That's the only thing.
Who do you imitate?
Anybody you admire, I should have thought. You may not imitate them in any way which is actually obvious to an outsider. actually, who doesn't know that you've got such and such in your head at the time you're working. But, I mean, various people are important to you at different times, and it's not necessarily definitive. You know, it's an obsession business again, actually. You know, you can be obsessed with certain writers, certain groups of writers, and think they're... I had a long period of involvement with what was called at the time, perhaps still is called, the New York School of Poets.
This would be Ashbery and...
No, this would be O'Hara and some of the younger guys, and also some free-swinging writers, Lewis Walsh and Ted Berrigan and people like that. And I had a very heavy involvement in them, and we collected an enormous amount of waste paper of various kinds in connection with those people, and we looked at it very hard and never wrote anything remotely resembling it, really, as far as I can remember, or very little. And yet that must have made some difference. You know, it's just that the style of it was so obviously American,
yes,
totally American, that I couldn't conceive of myself attempting it without committing some awful blunder of some kind.
You think of yourself as a British poet. Is this a meaningful term?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, nationality is a reality to poets and to musicians. That's one of the things I discovered about music. Music isn't actually an international language. It just looks as though it is. Yeah, nationality is obviously a factor of poetry for linguistic reasons, and the American language is a different language.
Mm.
You know, all this, of course, much easier to translate than French or any of those. You know.
Yeah.
But you don't need to. It is different.
You talked about music as an obsession. There's a group of poems, five pieces in two sets, which you subtitle Due to Music.
I was trying to avoid influence, I think. That's why I put due to, owing to.
Yeah. So that, what was the relationship between music and poetry? Was it... translating concepts from one art form into the other, or were you trying to write the equivalent of a jazz improvisation using words?
It wasn't the latter, certainly, and it wasn't exactly a translation either. It was to take something you admire, like it could just as easily have been a painting or anything else, and see if you could use it in any way creatively that is not just in a passive way, but actually produce something as a result of it. In that sense, what you did would be due to it, would be owing to it, as it would be a result of it, in that sense. Some of my poetry, like that, is actually a sort of process which you could conceive as starting as prose, like as if I were to listen to that music and write about it, review it, write essays about it and things like that. And then... this doesn't actually take place, but it's as if it did. A process of refinement could follow, from which you end up with poems. Condensation, perhaps, refinement, which isn't just elimination of things, it's also addition of things as well, broadening of the field of reference of the text in this conceptual process I'm talking about. They could end up with a poem. That's just one kind of concept of poetry writing. It's not the only one I operate, I don't think.
Can I just quote a couple of lines from the last of those five poems, Universal Silence? You say, musician, words, with me you are divided against me.
Yeah, that's not the meaningful in isolation, actually.
It's
an apostrophe. It's quite near the end, isn't it? It's a sort of apostrophe to this idea of musician who's been lurking behind the whole text right the way through the book.
Yeah.
Just a little sort of appeal to him. Aren't you going to help me to get over the next few lines or something like that? And he's not exactly, because he's got his own... he's divided. Yes, he's going to help me, and he's also going to be a nuisance. Which is one of the things that text is about, actually, as regards music, is that process helps you and hinders you at the same time. Any leaning on anything like that hinders you just as much as it helps, I should have thought. You know.
Hinders, because it restricts you?
And you are... the way of obsession does hinder behaviour, does limit and channel behaviour.
Perhaps just one last question, then we'll talk about those two poems.
Mm.
Yes, I'm wondering about the... if music has been such a strong influence, whether it is there more as a structuring of sound patterns, or if it is there conceptually in a more kind of cerebral fashion. I mean, how does one work out this relation between words and music?
I don't know. I'm beginning to think there isn't one, actually. And I've been involved with music for a long time. Still, I'm involved with music. I've got to know a lot of musicians as a result of it. And the more I got involved with it, the more I worked on it, I found it that the two things are best kept completely distinct in your head all the time. Now, there are other people who think differently. There's a poet called Anthony Barnett, who I know very well, who actually is a musician and has worked with a lot of quite important musicians, who thinks that the rhythm of his poetry is strongly related to the rhythm of certain... the rhythm produced by certain musicians who improvise, some post-jazz musicians. I think he's wrong, actually. I think his poetry would be exactly the same rhythm whether he were a musician or not. I was never able to find any way you could make a clear transfer from one art to the other, and the more distinct they became, the more fruitful they became.
So what would characterise poetry then?
Written verbal communication with all sorts of extras, all sorts of frills to it, whereas music is non-verbal communication of some kind, and you can try to analyse what that non-verbal communication is. And there are certain concepts you can take across. I mean, you discover that musicians have vocabularies, composers, improvisers, jazzmen, whatever they are, they have vocabularies of their own, which is an important concept in poetry, of course. There is a certain point at which you decide, not that the poetry is a music, but that the music is a language, if you follow me.
Yes.
So the transfer of interest and meaning and concepts was a bit in the opposite direction. It wasn't of the musicality of the poetry, the thing that's never interested me very much in those terms.
Mm.
It's the linguistic nature of the music I found much more interesting.
Linguistic?
Linguistic character of music. Yeah, music as a form of the utilisation of vocabulary and forming of, not concepts, but something like that.
Something like that.
Something like that, yes. Something roughly like that.
Would that be what the musicians, the instruments, was all about?
No, that was much more like the first thing I said, actually, the subjective reaction to the music. Taking each musician, or each instrument, as the case may be, as played, and sort of closing your eyes and surrendering to it. There's another concept which is very important to be coming in there, which is the concept of sort of immersion, poetic immersion. You have a notion for a poem and you completely immerse yourself in it. You'll get lost in it, so you sort of hardly know where you are or something. It's like closing your eyes and completely giving in to something as it sort of takes possession of you. You can do that with things like music and lots of other things.
Can you tell me, just because I'm ignorant, what exactly was Company Week?
Oh, that's to do with this, isn't it? Oh, that was just a series of concerts, all given by the same musicians. That's all. About 8 or 10 of them.
Yeah.
Improvising in small groups most of the time, over a week, which I attended and was supposed to be writing up. A book of poems occurred at the end instead of anything else. But that's all, yeah. And I was interested in how it developed during the week and became a kind of narrative. Again, it's this the shift's in the opposite direction. Again, it's a shift of linguistic terms over to my description of music, which was always what interested me.
Mm.
And that, I was interested in that week of music as a narrative sort of story which had a beginning and a middle and an end, without any conscious formulation of that kind on the part of the musicians themselves, since it wasn't composed music. and strictly speaking, shouldn't have had any formal characteristics whatsoever, really being purely improvised.
Yeah. Can I ask you to read the, perhaps the two poems?
These are from towards the end of a sequence in two parts. There's 10 poems named after individual musicians called essays. Then there are 10, that's called the musicians. Then there's a section called the instruments, which is 10 poems, mostly prose poems, each with the title of a musical instrument. There's nothing very complicated about that. It just means that I'm interested in the colour, if you like, colour characteristics of each instrument in relation to what you can do with that as defining an area within which you write a poem, I suppose. These are right at the end of that. These are 7 and 8 of the 10 poems. Not introduced in some way. It is part of a... That's the difficulty. Yes. It is part of a sequence. It's a bit... The point about this one is it's a bit of a shock when you turn the page from these prose poems and suddenly see a thing rhyming in quatrains. It's the only one in the book. And it's called... One of the musicians I was involved with here plays toy instruments, mainly. So there was going to be a piece called Toy Instruments. And this is what I made of it. Anyway, I'll read it. We are caught in a commerce and wring our fingers. The nurse is terse and the gypsum... Or is it gypsum? Do you know? Does anybody know whether it's gypsum or gypsum? I knew once... Gypsum, do you think? No, anyway. The nurse is terse and the gypsum lingers. I don't like gypsum. The nurse is terse and the gypsum lingers. Gypsum's what plaster of Paris is made from. The examination is only a game that starts at the end and begins again. Play with the toys that reflect the stars and suffer the noise that bites at its bars like a broken clock in a school of music, smiling back at whoever views it. Father has locked in stone and bricks the key to the clocks and covered with sticks the hole to the heart, secure from rival. We're waiting to start. Method survival. Turn to the next one. The alto saxophone one. This is a difficult one. Reaching again over the wedge to a meeting outside. The wedge is the reed of the saxophone. To manipulate a conflict, aftermath of a clash and a division by the constant parity of metal and wood, hence a double voice. Blow on the leaf and it trembles in the clearing, into nothing, when a beaten call takes it up and all the cancelled answers clinging to the insides of the question and all the cancelled questions blown along the street. Yes, we must be mad, sitting or bending here in the light of our own sweat, while the tourists trample the answers into the mud out there in the closed city, mad as the dipper over the stream, charging his fruited line. A force that gathers then at the cross tie of various attempts to live, alone, together, apart, away, and down. And up again, never quite giving in to the gravity of the situation, bearing always the court sheen of wasted time along the throat. Method. Do madmen have methods? Blow on the leaf and it trembles in the clearing. Let the bird go and it skims the river face. I should explain there were various rules involved in the writing of this sequence, which was that towards the, right at the end, the last item of each one is headed method. It's much, very much clearer in the early ones, where there's a disquisition, a sort of fairly subjective disquisition like that, on the colour characteristics of each instrument, and what that is, what the instrument represents as a challenge before the instrumentalist, and then a bit called method, which is meant to say how you cope with this dreadful object which has been put between you and the realisation of your music, but without which you can't do a thing. And the method bit breaks down in the last 3 or 4 poems and begins to break down in that last one. But the mention of the word method at the end is always sort of compulsory. It's a rule of writing this set of poems.
Yes, it takes one of the first few poems to realise that that's the rule, I think. And then the one before toy instruments is the guitar.
Yeah.
Where the method is the same as the...
Yes.
Description of the instrument.
That's where the method notion begins to be. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. You said the alto saxophone is difficult. Why is it difficult?
Because I made it difficult, I suppose. It's a it's almost a sort of phenomenology of the alto saxophone, that thing. I mean, the one before is light. You know, it's a joke in many ways, the toy poems one. The alto saxophone one is a real attempt to hammer out a problem, which is, you know, what is the quality of music which cannot be separated from the physical details of, in this case, the alto saxophone, and what is actually taking place. And the research here would involve also, well, nothing very out of the ordinary, but how the sound is made. The imagery is, you know, constantly refers to the what actually happens inside an alto saxophone. The breath of wind from the player's lips is broken into two by the reed, and one of these strands sets up a vibrating column of air, which is varied in length in various ways. But it's the reed; it's sort of that like a sort of knife blade up to the teeth, which is an image that didn't get into there, did it? Just occurred to me, actually. Oh, that's very good. It's something like that. Yeah, it says, you know, right the way through, there's the images which derive from that. It's also metal and wood. The wood is the not strictly wood. It's the wood of the keys and the reed. It is a double voice, that kind of thing. A beaten call is the outside of the thing.
I was just about to ask, what is a call?
In this case, it's the outside. It's the surface, isn't it? Basically. Now that you ask me, I'm not at all sure what a call is, but that's what I had in mind at the time. Yeah. There are different ways of writing poetry, and these were composed by the sort of 60% unconscious method, actually. The amount of unconsciousness in writing poetry varies, I'd say, roughly from 90% at the extreme, which is what, if it were 90%, it would be a dictated poetry, and the muse would actually be breathing the stuff through you, and you'd hardly know anything. And that would be like 95% unconscious, to as little as perhaps 10 or 20%, but there's always something of it there, simply because of the speed at which you write. You can't know what you're doing.
Do you have any 95% poems?
I don't think that. Toy Instruments is actually was written very much in that kind of way. Perhaps it's more than 60%, actually. Because having got involved in a quatrain structure, that then takes hold of you and carries you through the poem.
Can you remember how you got involved in quatrains in the first place? Was that a conscious decision? Or?
Yeah, it was. I was thinking about toys, and therefore wanting to make something small, compact.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, the references to, and it's of course all to infancy and things like that. And when you get into that sort of quite dangerous area, actually, I mean, there are hints at strange Freudian things in that text. Then you want a control element.
Yeah.
And this, in this case, the form is the control element, which brings hopefully a lightness, a light relief into it from the start, you know, before you've begun, really. Because the imagery is actually very threatening right the way through it.
What the nurse and...
All of them, yes. Authoritarian figures threatening the child, who is trapped in various ways. The exits are blocked and things like that, you know. And the contrast in size, I suppose, in different parts of it. Broken clocks. It's a bit like an early De Chirico painting or something like that.
What do broken clocks signify?
Yes, what indeed, yeah.
What is gypsum?
It's what plaster of Paris is made of.
Mm.
So if you have a plaster cast or anything, that's what you're involved with.
Mm.
It's also white, a white pure substance which sets solid. Now these things, all everything I say about this poem is ulterior to it. It is a largely dictated poem.
Mm.
This actually, it's bound to be with that this kind of format to it. And the phonetics of a dictated poem of this kind are very important too, not just the rhyme, but to be in a tense self-consciousness of sound effects right the way through it, I suppose. Nurses terse, inner rhymes, all sorts of things. Ring fingers, nurses terse. Yeah. It's easy to start with something like that. It's carrying on for four or five stanzas. It becomes really difficult to maintain the intensity of sound self-consciousness through it.
So the sound is self-conscious even if you're not quite conscious of what you're...
No, I don't mean self-conscious at the time of writing. Well, yes, it is, because that's how you operate. Your method of writing is you write by sound to quite a large extent. Which you'd have a lot of poets write, a lot of the time, actually. You can... I've seen it a lot, especially if you're writing songs. You look at Shakespeare's songs, it's very obvious quite a lot of the time that he was using sound as his medium of progression through the poem. In fact, there are some poets, I think, who are totally interesting as for the sound of their poems, and the content is sort of totally boring, actually. Some of the... do you know a poet called Carl Riccosi?
Riccosi,
he's a very interesting poet, but I find his content sort of totally... But which say nothing worth saying at all, somehow, ever. I don't know why not, but...
How important is the rhythm of unspoken voices to poetry?
You mean my...
Yes,
my spoken...
Wouldn't it? No, not necessarily yours, but perhaps different dialects
within it. I don't know. See, the sound of a... When you talk about the sound of a poem, you mean two completely distinct things. You mean the actual physical sound that you can hear with your ear when somebody reads it, and letters as notations. Yeah, and letters as notations of sound. That is simply vowels and things like that. Especially for a poem like this, that latter is very important. But that's not particularly the sound of my voice. It's just the generalised sound of the English language. That
you speak about lineation, which is obviously important in a rhymed quatrain poem. With those prose poems, is there any sense of lineation at all?
Yeah, because I can't sort of go back to the beginning of a line without being aware of it, even when I'm writing a prose poem. Actually,
so that what you composed in the typewriter is. Has the same lineation as what we have here.
Yes.
Oh.
There are occasions where, when you have, especially if you've got a biggish paragraph, you let it go. Actually, but I am personally always aware. Sometimes, what I'm saying is, sometimes it doesn't matter. Even if you're aware of it, just because you're aware of something doesn't mean to say it matters. Quite often, it doesn't matter at all. But I'm nevertheless always aware that the end of a line is. It's more than a break, actually. It's a kind of little question mark, the end of a line, except for the end of the last line, or the end of a stanza line. There's always some doubt, which is why I tend to have the verb at the end of the line and its object at the beginning of the next line, quite often. Actually, that's probably a common pattern in my poetry, because you've got a verb, a transitive verb, and then setting up the question, it does something, as though this question, it does what, which you answer at the beginning of the next line, thus forming a stress construct, I suppose.
Do you always know the answer when you're writing?
Probably, yes.
Mm.
Yeah, and, I mean, the points at which you get stuck along the process of writing a poem won't be the points at which, necessarily, at which the poem pauses, and there are breaks when the thing's actually finished. There's no reason why they should be. Anyway, after all, I mean, it's solely, totally the poet's concern where he gets stuck in the process of doing it. It's nobody else's problem at all, that. There's no reason why the poem should have to record that struggle, as far as I can see. I mean, some poets think that it's a documentation of the creative process, you know, as a kind of continuum, a broken continuum, and you have to record what you're, and you're recording the faults and stutters and impasses as they come along, which is sort of fair enough in a way, but that denies the validity of the total, of the whole poem as a unit in the end, you know. There's a reference to something. I don't know what it was. That "Yes, we must be mad." I'm just trying to remember what it. Does anybody remember that? It's some famous jazz musician said something about he couldn't understand why he was sitting down here playing in some dirty cellar bar under the streets of the city while everybody else was up there having a good time. Yet he went on doing it. I can't remember what it was now. It wasn't Charlie Parker, but it was somebody like that. Said that, and that's what that paragraph is about, just a basic agreement right there, and a sort of bit of an answer to it as well, actually.
What matters the differ?
And the notion of questions and answers. If you're up there having a good time, then you must know all the answers. And we're presumably down here sweating away in a cellar because we don't know the answers, or we're seeking to find them out, or something like that, or we're answering different questions anyway.
I wonder if you'd like to read the guitar.
Well, it won't take long.
No,
I know. But then that's the one immediately before. Then yes. It would be very, very, very meaningful, actually, because that's very much in the sequence. The fact that there's almost no poem there is important. But going along through this sequence of poems, I dealt with. So you've got your trumpet, cello, soprano, saxophone, piano. All of them had things like that alto sax one. And you had percussion, and then guitar. And at this point in the sequence, it's as if you've had enough of this sort of thing. And I did write quite a long poem about the guitar, and finally ended up with one line, which was, "Oh, entrails stretched across the negative rows!" ! Which seemed quite sufficient. So I crossed out all the rest. And since I had to have method, I then put method at the bottom, colon, "Oh, entrails stretched across the negative rows!" Yes. Which is a kind of description of a guitar, actually.
Yes.
It's as if, some Martian came down and asked you, "What is this guitar?" You'd say, "Well, it's entrails stretched across negative rows, ain't it?" Everybody knows that. There's always a joke element in my poetry that's, actually, a sort of serious joke element. That's using the last vocabulary you'd think of to give a description of a guitar, which I hope is still an accurate good description of a guitar, with some vaguely medieval philosophical overtones, which I prefer not to go into.
Okay.